Think for a minute about the last time you received a gift. Were you surprised? Now, maybe you were surprised at the gift itself. You know, oh, wow, a new fishing pole, just what I always wanted. But were you surprised at the fact that you got the gift? Let's say it was last Christmas or maybe your last birthday. You know, you may have gone, oh, look, you know, it's a new lampshade or, you know, something. But the fact that you got a gift probably didn't really shock you because, after all, it was Christmas or your birthday or whatever the case may be. You were expecting something, right? Maybe you didn't know what you were expecting, but you were expecting something. So in that sense, it wasn't a surprise. Now, think about this for a minute. When the Lord comes, will you be surprised? Will that event take you by surprise? Or are you expecting it? Are you expecting Him? Listen to this from 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. But according to the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you. For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness so that this day should overtake you as a thief. Did you catch that last part? We hear a lot about the Lord coming like a thief in the night. You don't know when to expect it. But He tells us right here that God's people, that won't be such a surprising event. It won't be such a shock. We'll be expecting it as God's people who believe God's promises as set forth in God's word. His coming should not overtake us like a thief in the night. Now, where are you at with that? Because His coming really shouldn't take us by surprise. In fact, we ought to be expecting the Lord to come at any minute. As far as the Bible is concerned, everything is ready. Everything that has to happen has happened. The stage is set. And the only thing the Lord is waiting for is for one more soul to surrender itself to His grace. And when the time is ripe, and when the last sinner turns their lives over to the Lord, then in an instant, the voice of the archangel, in the blink of an eye, the Lord comes for His people. Now, we ought to be expecting the Lord at any minute. And the way we live ought to reveal that expectation. Today, we're going to learn about faith that works while you're waiting. And here's the thing. We will all stand before the Lord one day. Whether it's in 50 years or 5 years or 5 minutes or 5 seconds, we will all stand before the Lord. That it's going to happen. He is going to come. And when He does, how are you going to account for what you've done with what you've been given to work with? How's that going to go? If you're really living in the light of the Lord's return, that reality will be reflected in several ways. And this morning we're going to talk about two of those that are covered here in the first part of James 5. And the first one is this. While you're waiting, you're going to invest in things that are eternal. Read with me, starting in verse 1 of James 5. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Notice this come now is just like the come now from verse 13. It's that James has such a personality, and if James were speaking today, he would probably say, come on, you know. Come on, guys, come now, he says. You who say today or tomorrow will go to such and such, verse 13. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You've heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you've kept back by fraud, cry out. And the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, which means Lord of hosts. I don't know why they didn't just say that. You've lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You've fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You've condemned, you've murdered the just. He doesn't resist you. While you're waiting, you're going to invest in things that are eternal. See, earthly treasure creates the illusion of security. But it's just that. It's only an illusion. You know, David Copperfield doesn't really set himself on fire and then step behind the curtain and suddenly appear at the back of the room. It's an illusion. It's not real. He tells us that this is just an illusion. Verse 2 uses the word riches, but he's not talking about money, not yet. He's going to give us here three things that, that reveal our eternal nature of our investment. You know, you have to ask, what is your treasure? And there are three different kinds of treasure mentioned here, all of which have to do with things that are earthly and temporary. Verse 2, he uses the word riches, and he's not talking about money in the bank. When we think of someone who's rich, we think they have money in the bank. He's going to talk about money in a minute when he talks about gold and silver. But when he uses the word riches here, you might just substitute the word resources. You know, the things that you have to work with. That's what he's really talking about. Now, for these folks, these riches might have been a field of wheat or a flock of sheep, a silo full of grain, the kinds of things that they were resting in or depending on. You know, in our days, it might be a freezer full of beef. You know, my mom always kept the freezer. We had one of those big wide things, and there was two things. There was always cookies in there, and there was always more beef than you can imagine. And see, I thought it was normal. I thought everybody had a freezer full of beef, and every night for dinner you had roast or steak or, you know, hamburger or something, until I was a teenager and kind of went into that organic hippie phase, vegetarian and all that. And for the first time in my life, somebody prepared a big pot of beans. And I thought it was the coolest thing ever. I didn't know you could eat beans. I mean, big pot of beans, boil them for, I don't know, 3 or 4 days or something to get them. And I remember going home, I'm like 16 or 17, and I said, Mom, you wouldn't believe what they gave us. She said, I went to eat, and they gave us this big bowl of beans. She goes, beans? Are you kidding me? When I was growing up, all we ever had to eat was beans, and I swore I'd never eat beans again, and that's why we have a freezer full of beef, and why you grew up eating steak and roast and hamburger every night. You know, it's those things that you put them in the freezer, or you have the grain full of silo. You have your riches, your resources set aside, the things, you know, in another culture, you might think of it as your stash. Careful. You know, but the stuff that you have set aside to take care of you on a rainy day, you know, to the food you eat, the things that are going to take care of you. Now, it is good to be prepared in an emergency. It's not that we shouldn't have anything stored up, but those things are going to rot. Your riches, he says, are corrupted. You know, they're rotted or they're rotting. Because they don't have any eternal value. You can't take it with you. And it is all going to burn. So you can store it up. You can have your fallout shelter with 10,000 gallons of water and a couple of tons of spam and whatever you think is going to see you through, whether it was Y2K or the coming apocalypse or, you know, it's all going to rot. That's what he tells us here. Your riches are corrupted. They have no eternal value, and neither do, he says here, fine clothes, and your garments are moth-eaten. Well, when this was written, nearly every home had a dirt floor. The modes of transportation were either your 2 feet or the 4 feet of a donkey or maybe a horse or an ox or some animal. That was it. And so when you were wealthy, you didn't show up in your Maserati or your Ferrari with your Rolex watch and your, you know, $300 alligator skin shoes or however, you know, the only way they had of showing wealth, of kind of proclaiming their wealth, was by the way they dressed. And primarily what that meant was purple. Now don't take this to heart, Sherry. Because purple was hard to come by. The dye to make purple that wouldn't just wash out, you know, in a couple of washings was very hard to come by and very expensive. And if I remember right, it took a certain sea snail, the shell of a certain sea snail, to be harvested and ground up and turned into dye, because everything else that made purple would just wash out after a while. And of course, in a culture whose clothing was primarily wool, you know, this is a sheep-raising agrarian culture, and you'd shear the sheep, and you'd, you know, get a loom, and you'd make thread and yarn, and everybody's clothes were the same color. They were that kind of off-white, light brown color of sheep's wool. And if you had money, then you could have something like Jesus had, that garment without a seam. Remember that? It was knit together or woven together in a single piece. Or remember back when Abraham had that, they call it a coat of many colors. Jacob had that coat of many colors made for Joseph, and really was one of the key factors in his brother's jealousy that got him killed. That this fine clothing and with purple was just the way that you showed how wealthy you were, you know, how well to do you were. They made a statement. Now, for us, our statement of riches or of wealth isn't so much the clothes, although there is that whole factor with Rolex watches and expensive stuff. Shoot, I was going to buy a shirt the other day out of a catalog, and it was $50. $50 for a shirt. You got to be rich to buy a shirt. And that's not some fancy schmancy. I think it was Eddie Bauer or something, you know, and I don't know. I'm going to just shop at Costco from now on. I think this shirt cost $7. And I had to think about that, but I got it. But, you know, I mean, expensive clothes are one thing. But for us, primarily the way that we reveal our wealth is in really the toys that we have. You know, you might have four-wheelers and snowmobiles and jet skis and, you know, guitars. I don't know. I think guitars are probably okay. But the rest of that stuff, you know, if you've got a couple of really nice jet skis on a really nice trailer being pulled by a really nice pickup, and you only take it out of the shop to drive it for those few months out of the year when jet skis are really the thing to do, you know, whether you're trying to or not, you're letting everybody know that, hey, I can afford these things. And if you've got all that stuff, the jet skis, the four-wheelers, and the boat, and the RV, and the trailer, and the this and the that, and the new and the room full of guitars, or, I don't throw things, but a room full of scrapbook supplies. Hey, that ain't cheap. I balanced the checkbook at our house, and I know that that stuff is not cheap. and you come over and, oh, look at my stuff. And you want everybody to go, ooh, ah, look, oh, you've got one of those paper cutters. Oh, you've got the hole punch with the hearts and the stars. Oh, man. You know, and that's just kind of the equivalent here when he says, you know, your fine clothing, your stuff. We have stuff. Do we not have stuff? We have so much stuff, we have to rent space to store it. That may be the definition of how dumb can you get. I've got so much stuff that I've got to spend $100 or $200 a month just to rent a place to put it because I have it and I don't need it. I don't use it very much, but I'm keeping it. And so I'm storing it down there. That's the idea here. He says, you know, not only are your riches corrupted, but your garments are moth-eaten. You know, it's the same thing. It's not a sin to have that stuff. You know, praise the Lord for fun and for toys and all that. But you got to realize that it's all going to rust and rot. The moths are going to eat it. You know, we're talking about investing in things that are eternal. And those things, as much fun as they might be, they have no eternal value. And as strange as it may seem, neither does money. That's what verse 3 starts off with. Your gold and silver are corroded. See, when you stand before the Lord, all your stuff, all your toys, and all your money, it's not going to mean a thing. Now, catch the sarcasm here at the end of verse 3. And their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. You know, when you're standing or sitting in piles of rotted, rusted, decaying stuff, piles of cash that the moths have eaten through and toys that no longer work because they're rusted and worn out, and all the finest stuff you can think of, you know, it's going to be meaningless. It'll be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. See, that's the regret. When you look around in light of the Lord's coming at all your stuff that is worthless, and the Lord says, what have you done with what you had to work with? Well, I had a really cool motorcycle. Does that count? No. You know, it's fun, but it has no eternal value. Earthly treasure creates the illusion of security. Sit back in my new house. Watch my new TV. Go out and ride my new motorcycle. So I can feel pretty good about life. You know, I thank the Lord for the blessings and beg him to help me make the payments, you know. Please, God, please. But when the sky cracks open and the Lord comes down and the trumpet of the archangel shouts and we're all caught up in the twinkling of an eye, I'm going to be waving goodbye to all that stuff, never to return to it. And I hope it doesn't take until that minute for me to come to the realization that, yeah, it's okay to have stuff and you need a house and you need transportation and all the rest, but is my sense of security and my sense of worth and satisfaction really tied up in that stuff? And I think we're going to feel pretty silly if that's the case when that time comes. Earthly treasure creates only the illusion of security, but in the end they have no value whatsoever. So then the question has to be, well, what good is all that stuff? I mean, are you telling me I should just go live in a cave, you know, get one outfit, one of those lamb's wool outfits, you know, and just kind of sit in the cave and pray and read my Bible and be religious? No. That's not necessary. It's not helpful. It's not needed. And it's not at all what I would ever suggest. But here's an equation that explains the worldly treasures that we stack up or what to do with them. You might want to write this down. I meant to put it in the notes, but I didn't. Wealth plus godliness equals a generous spirit. Wealth and godliness. Now, by godliness, I don't mean godlikeness. That's not what the word means. Godliness means that intimate spiritual relationship that I have with the Lord, my closeness to the Lord. Now, sometimes that closeness with the Lord may reflect in what appears to be God-like or Christ-likeness, but that's more of a byproduct. It's a fruit of the reality. Godliness is just that intimate spiritual connection I have with God. Now, that connection plus worldly wealth equals a generous spirit. A couple of Proverbs. Jot these down. You can look them up later. Proverbs 11:25 tells us that the generous soul will be made rich, and he who waters will also be watered himself. Proverbs 22:9. He who has a generous eye will be blessed, for he gives of his bread to the poor. Here's the point. A generous spirit reveals a changed heart. See, worldly wealth only gives the illusion of security, but a generous spirit reveals a changed heart. Turn back with me to Luke chapter 19. And we're going to read a few verses about a guy whose story you may recognize. But this is a fellow who lived in that worldly, saving up money and wearing the fine clothes and collecting all the right toys until the Lord touched his life, changed his life, and watched the way he reacts. Luke chapter 19, right in verse 1, says, "Then Jesus entered and passed through Jericho." Now, he's on his way to Jerusalem to be crucified. He's on the road, and Jericho's at the bottom of the hill that windy road goes up to Jerusalem. Now, behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus, who was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. Now, let's just do a little reminder here. A tax collector was responsible to collect and then submit taxes for and to Rome. He'd have a booth, and as the merchants and the caravans would come by, he would kind of eyeball their product and what they were doing, and kind of like a toll. And he would set a certain amount. And there's a couple of Roman soldiers there with their spears ready to enforce Zacchaeus's conclusion. And he would demand a certain amount, and that would be submitted to Rome. Now, the way that the tax collector made his own living, his own salary, his paycheck, came from inflating the taxes and then keeping the difference between what he had to give to Rome and what he collected. Now, he could set that amount anywhere he wanted. And if it was a little high, well, tough. And if he needed to pay off the Roman guards to enforce his inflated taxes, and that was kind of part of the program too. So that's what it means when he was a tax collector. He was the chief tax collector. So Zacchaeus in Jericho, and Jericho is one of those places where the roads in that part of the country going north, south, or up the hill to Jerusalem, you have to go through Jericho. You can't really get anywhere. You can't get up there anyway without going through Jericho. Lots of taxes, lots of money, and he was rich. He was rich. And he sought to see who Jesus was, but couldn't because of the crowd, for he was short of stature. Just a little guy, he's a short guy. So he ran ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was going to pass that way. Now imagine, this is the chief tax collector, and he's got his finery on and the bracelets and rings and who knows what else. And then he goes and he shinnies up this tree. He climbs up a sycamore tree because he's trying to see over the tops of all the heads, because he's heard about Jesus, this holy man, this preacher, this miracle worker, and he's passing through, and Jesus has quite an entourage with him, and the crowd's gathered around, kind of lining the street. They want to see him, and so Zacchaeus climbs up this tree. I think it's Gail Irwin that talks about Jesus the mighty hunter. Zacchaeus, he doesn't even know the Lord's after him, but Jesus already has him treed. I like that. And when Jesus came to the place, this is verse 5, he looked up and he saw him. And he said, Thou art evil, you tax collector who robs from the poor and gives to the rich. And that's not what he said, is it? You might think he would, but that's not what he said. He looked up and said, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must stay at your house. He must. Not he might, or he's thinking about it. I must stay at your house. Wow. So he made haste and he came down and received him joyfully. But when they saw it, the crowd and the religious people, they all complained, saying, he's gone to be a guest with a man who is a sinner. Well, you know, that's pretty much who Jesus hung out with. You know, people like us. People who need a Savior. Then Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, look, Lord, I give half my goods to the poor. And if I've taken anything from anyone, wait a minute, if? How about since? Because? In light of the fact that I have taken anything from anyone by false accusation, I restore fourfold. Now realize that if Zacchaeus were to be arrested and formally charged with extortion and found guilty, the penalty would be 25%. And here he is offering 400% in return. See, that's how the Lord changes hearts. In verse 9, Jesus said to him, today, salvation has come to this house because he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost. Now, pay careful attention. Zacchaeus giving half his stuff to the poor and restoring fourfold to those who he'd ripped off, that didn't save him. Jesus didn't say, now you're saved because you've done this. He says, today salvation has come to this house. Today, Zacchaeus, I can see. Just by watching the way you act and react, I can tell that you too are a son of Abraham, which from another study you'll remember means Abraham, the father of our faith, the one who kind of set the pace for salvation by trusting God. Zacchaeus, a generous spirit reveals a changed heart. Now, I read this story, and I can't remember the fellow's name, and this was probably 10 or 15 years ago. It was a man in Chicago. It was a rich man. He was born rich. He had money to start with, and he invested wisely, and he ran his business well, and he had lots of money. And then one day he gave his life to the Lord, kind of like Zacchaeus. He saw that he was a sinner. And without intervention from the Lord to save him, he really had no hope, and that all of his money and all of his stuff wasn't going to matter. You know, when only one thing mattered when he faced the Lord, all of his stuff and his riches weren't going to be part of it. And so he confessed his sin and he turned his life over to the Lord, and the Lord came into his life, and this man was changed dramatically, a lot like Zacchaeus was changed. So he made a decision. Because he was so rich, he had the advantage of being debt free. So he moved himself out of the mansion into a regular old house in a regular old neighborhood. And he got rid of his chauffeur and the limousines and all that, and just bought a regular car. I don't know, a Geo Metro or a Ford Focus or something. I don't know, but just a regular old car. And he went to the accountants and the people at his business empire, really, and he had them lower his salary to $30,000 a year. So he had no debt, had an okay house. Had a car, $30,000 a year. He figured that's all he needed to live comfortably. What did he do with the millions and millions and millions that he had left over? He gave it away. He gave it to ministries and missions. He gave it to the Lord's work. And the more he earned, the more he gave away. And he just lived this modest, comfortable, reasonable, modest life and gave all the rest of that money away. See, that's what it's really all about. While you're waiting for the Lord, you invest in things that are eternal. That's the first thing. Then, verses 7 through 11, while you're waiting, or faith that works while you're waiting, you endure patiently. And that means a couple of things. First of all, it means you wait for the Lord's return with an expectant heart. Verse 7, therefore, he says, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. An expecting heart. Now, I'll bet I'm not the only guy here who, while we were growing up, and this is primarily fellas I'm talking to, heard these words. Just wait till your father gets home. See, I knew somebody out there. I knew it wasn't just me. Just wait till your father gets home. I heard that pretty regular. You just wait till your father gets home. My dad traveled sometimes with his work, so sometimes that wait would be a day or two. And that's a bummer, that waiting for your father to get home so he can get in trouble and you know it's coming. And I had this this technique that I worked out. My dad got off work about 5 o'clock, usually, and it took him about 15 minutes to get home. So 5:15, I'd hear the car, door would open. So at about 5:10, I figured out that it would just be a perfect time to take a nap. And so at 10 minutes after 5, I'd go lay down and pretend to be asleep. And I'd hear the car pull in at 5:15, the door open up and close, and I could hear my mom say, you won't believe what he did today, you know. And I'd hear my dad say, I'll take care of it, mother. I'll talk to him, you know. And then I'd sleep till 6, 7, sometimes 8 o'clock, you know. And then finally it's like, well, I got to get up sometime because I got to go to bed pretty soon. And it would be, Ronnie, come back here in the bedroom. I want to talk to you. Now, that was bad enough. Now, if it was this move here, Ronnie, come back in the bedroom, then you were really in trouble. But waiting for my dad to get home when I was in trouble was not a fun wait. And I know you know what I mean. But there was one time, I think I was 13, 14 years old. I'd gone down to this music store in Vancouver. You know, we grew up in a musical family. And at this music store, I remember American Music, used to be right next door to the old Kiggins Theater on Main Street. And I got out of the movie and I'd go hang in the music store, and they had in there this Fender pedal steel guitar. And I just would drool and imagine. And I'd go in this, and I'd sit down behind it, and I didn't know how to play it. And some of you may not even know what it is. You kind of sit under it and behind it and almost like that keyboard, except there are strings on it, and you push pedals, and you play the strings, and you move this thing up and down. And I always loved the way it sounded. I'd seen guys play it, and there was one in the music store, and I thought, man, this is cool. I want to play this thing. And so I'd go sit there, and I'd walk, squawk, until the guy would say, kid, get out of here, you know, before you break it. And the thing is, it costs like $1,000. Now, we're talking 60-something. Might as well have been a million. You know, $1,000 back then, it's still a lot of money. And it was even more money back then. Now, my folks don't have $1,000 to spend on what's basically a toy for me. So I don't have much hope of ever getting a pedal steel guitar, but I just pined for it. I dreamed about it. In fact, I learned how to play it by thinking about it. I'd sit down in the music store and go, and I'd see how it worked, and I'd go home, and in my sleep, I'd be going, and this string there, and you pick that string and push that pedal. And by the time, years later, when I got one, I just pretty much knew how to play it. But on with the story. I wanted to have a pedal steel guitar desperately. No way we could afford it. No way I could afford it. There's just not going to happen. Till one time my dad comes home from a business trip and he says, hey, I met this guy over in Richland who, down in his basement, he builds pedal steel guitars. And I went, yeah. And he said, and he builds them for like, you know, it's only a couple $100, $150, $200. And I went, yeah. And he said, so I told him to go ahead and build one. And next time I go over to Richland, I'm going to pick it up and bring it home. I was like, yes, you know, yes, this is the biggest day of my life. Now that was a long wait. When are you going back, Dad? Well, it's going to be a couple, 2-3 months. You know, I don't know if I can, I might explode. I don't know if I can wait that long. And so months go, and you know, you think I'm going to forget about it? No way. Every Monday morning, where are you going this week, Dad? Well, I'm going down to Pullman. Oh, where are you going this week, Dad? Well, I got to go over to Moses Lake. Oh, well, where are you going this week? Finally, month, 2-3 months go by. Finally, it's where are you going? He goes, well, I think I'm going to head back over to Tri-Cities. I'll go over to Richland and I'll pick up that pedal steel guitar. Yes. And so he's gone all week long. I think it's like Thursday night. He's supposed to come home. He's not going to come home at 5 o'clock because he's driving all the way from Richland. Or, yeah. And so, you know, I'm sitting on the couch and I'm 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. Mom goes to bed. My sister's in her room. I don't know. I'm staying up and I'm waiting and I'm not sleeping on the couch this time. And so it's finally, it's like maybe 11:30, I hear the car pull up in the driveway. And my dad walks in. What are you doing up? I'm just up. And he kind of goes, it's in the car. So I ran out to the car and got the thing. Now here's the difference. Waiting for your father to get home when you're going to get in trouble, that's one thing. But waiting for your father to get home when he's bringing you the best gift that you can imagine that you've always wanted and are dying to have, that's a completely different thing. And when James says to endure patiently, that's what he's talking about. You wait with an expecting heart, with that attitude that says, you know, is that it? I heard a sound. Was that the Lord? Is that, you know, was that the archangel's trumpet? Was that the sky? No, that was just, you know, that was the neighbor's cow. Okay, that wasn't it. You know, but that waiting and being anticipating and ready every second for it. Now in verse 7, he continues to describe this. He says, see how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rain. Well, I don't know how many farmers we've got here. You know, some of you guys I know are in the timber industry, and that's a kind of farming. You know, and when you, well, it's a little different with trees, but let's say the garden at your house, you know, when you plant the seed, the carrots or the lettuce or the whatever it is, you don't run out there the next morning and say, oh, it's not there. I guess it didn't take. I guess it didn't grow. Mary and I planted a garden years ago, and that was kind of our approach. We tilled up the soil and put everything in nice, neat little rows and have the corn on the, you know, right side of the garden so it wouldn't block the, put shade the other plants. And I go out there like the, you know, the first day if we planted, no, nothing yet. In a week, no, nothing yet. 2 weeks, no, not yet. I don't know how long it was, 3 weeks, a month. I lost track of time. One day we go out there and look, and there's this stuff coming up, and I'm thinking, well, it didn't work because the grass is just growing back. You know, there's something wrong with these seeds, or there's something wrong with this dirt, or we did something wrong. But then you look a little closer and go, no, wait a minute, that's not grass. That's a carrot. It's working. It's grown. See, farmers know that. You know, on a big farm, you're out there with the tractor or the combine or the discs or whatever, and you're working the soil and you plant and you water. And a farmer knows that it's not an instant gratification kind of a thing. You got to wait until the right season. And that's what the Lord's telling us. You know, wait patiently, expectantly. See, a farmer knows that crop is coming. Well, gee, Grandpa, is the corn ever going to come up? Yeah, it's coming. Just wait. There's no doubt about it, I guess, is the point. There's no wondering, is it really going to work this time? Yeah, it works every time. The harvest doesn't come immediately. Now, he talks here about the early rain and the latter rain. In Israel, the early rains would be about in October. Their seasons are different from ours because of where they are on the planet in relation to the equator and all that. So their early rains for their growing season is in October. And then the later rains wouldn't be until March and April. And what he's saying here is that, you know, in the fullness of time, when, you know, this happens here and this happens there, but just be patient, but be expecting at the same time. You know, when the Lord comes, until the Lord comes, endure patiently with an expecting heart. And then he also talks about with an established heart. In verse 8, you also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. So don't grumble against one another, brethren. See, he knows he's winding this letter down, so he's going to refer back to a few of the points he already made. Don't grumble against one another, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. Didn't we just talk about that? If you judge your brother, you judge the law. My brethren, take the prophets. See, there's another example. This wait with an established heart. Wait with your heart rooted in the reality that Jesus is coming back. And the prophets are a great example. He doesn't name names here. He just uses the term prophets in a generic sense. But let's just take, for example, Jeremiah. Jeremiah boldly proclaimed the word of the Lord no matter what. And the things that he proclaimed, he never really saw come to pass, but he never stopped proclaiming them. He had his up seasons and his down seasons. That's why they call him the weeping prophet. He was kind of a depressed and probably a depressing guy, you know. You'd think his glass was half empty instead of half full. But he spoke the truth, the sad truth. Israel, you've turned your back on the Lord and you've left him no option but to turn his back on you. But if you'll turn back towards him, then he'll be there waiting for you. But if you don't, it's not going to be pretty. And nobody wanted to hear that bad news. You can jot this down, look it up later. In Jeremiah chapter 20, verse 2, Jeremiah comes into town and he kind of proclaims God's truth. And the priests are so thrilled with him, they put him in stocks. One of those deals, you know, where you're not fun. A little later, chapter 32, he does the same thing and they put him in prison. It says he was imprisoned in the courtyard of the guards. It's kind of like a bunny being thrown in the kennel with the dogs, you know. Not where you want to be. And a little later, it says he was put in a dungeon. Now, a dungeon's even worse than a prison. All of that, but still, he persisted, he endured, he waited, he trusted the Lord. He never gave up hope. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. He says, you've heard the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. We just finished Job in our Wednesday night study. And so those of you that are a part of that group, and I wish you all were, didn't remember because it's still fresh in our mind. You know, they said, Job, you know, I mean, he was a rich man. He had a big family. He had all that wealth, all that external stuff. And because the enemy said, he just loves you to the Lord. He says, he just loves you because you've blessed him so much. And the Lord said, no, I don't think so. I think he really loves me. And the enemy said, well, then let me take everything he has. And let's see if he still loves you. And the Lord said, well, okay. And he took everything. I mean, killed his kids, his crops, his flocks, his herds, all gone until Job finds himself sitting in a pile of ashes, scratching his open sores with a piece of broken pottery. How much worse does it have to get? And his friends just said, or with his wife said, just curse God and die. You know, just curse him. He doesn't care about you. See, look what he's done to you. Curse him and die. And Job said these famous words, though he slay me, I will trust him. And Job saw the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is compassionate and merciful. The Lord restored Job more than he ever had to start with. But above all, my brethren, don't swear. Next verse. We'll save that one for next week. Like a prophet, like Job, waiting with an established heart, settled on the reality that I know God loves me. I know He's coming back for me. I'm not going to waste my time and invest my resources in these things that aren't going to last. And what resources I do have to work with, I'm going to use to be a blessing to the Lord and to His kingdom. But there are those times when we are going to ask, well, you know, Lord, why did you let that happen? Or how could you let this happen to me? This loss or this tragedy or this, you know, business deal, anywhere from the stock market to the death of a loved one. Lord, how could you let this happen to me? And you know what? It's okay to ask that. It's only natural to ask that, to wonder that. Sometimes God seems far away. It seems like He's not listening or He's not paying attention. You know, where's His mercy? Where's His care? Where's His concern for me, for you? But even when it seems, and that's the key word, seems like God is far away, we can't lose sight of the fact that Jesus is coming back. It could happen before we leave here today. What will the Lord find you doing when He returns? That can be a scary question. What will He find you? What will you be in the middle of? I've always thought, wouldn't it be great if the Lord came while we were at church? While we're singing, "How great is our God?" Oh, there He is. Hey. You know, we all kind of float up and transformed into these slim, trim, buff bodies. What will you be doing when the Lord returns? Will you be storing up stuff and relying on riches to make you happy? Will you be concerned with the appearance of wealth? You know, worried about what you wear? Will you be collecting money and actually cheating others to get it? Or will you be waiting patiently, expectantly for Him, rooted in the reality of His return and living in the light of His love? How we live today reveals what we expect tomorrow. What are you expecting? Is your faith working while you wait?